It's a great starting place to do some inner work. It's probably where he's going to stop.
But you've opened my eyes. I now see it as a meaningful part of the story. I can grant that. Still didn't love it, but I like that it has a place.
Term coined in the late 1950s to describe the advertising executives of Madison Avenue. They coined it.
Hello? Hello? I can hear you.
Welcome to They Coined It. I'm Roberta Lipp.
Dan Jasper.
And it's the end of the season, y'all.
Last coin.
We made it. We made it. We literally, some of us, survived. To the end of this season.
Last coin of season 5, or as we call it, the nickel.
The final coin in the... Oh, okay. All right. Either way, we...
Weren't with me there. That's okay.
No, we never coined anything, actually, until just now, and then we failed. Hey, guys, here's what's going on. So, a reminder that this coming Saturday, the 13th, we are recording our They Joined It. That's our live video gather with the people.
Schmooze with the people.
Schmooze with the people. If you want to be one of those people, go over to patreon.com/theycoinedpod. It is the best way to support us regardless. And it's a really, it's a fun event. It's always been super fun.
Great to see everyone talk, get some thoughts out, listen to just people we don't hear from all the time, which is really, really cool on the show.
Yeah. And then we're going to do a little something the week after that. And then we're going to take a between seasons break, and then we'll be back. And y'all have been so patient this season, including my Dan Jasper. Thank you so much.
Hey, come on. We're a team. We got to get through this. We're good.
We're good. So.
I know electroshock therapy is a real thing. I think it's still used in certain ways now, not as prevalent, I think, as it was in the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest years. But I found it's really hard to watch. I found that whole back and forth really hard, especially the part where she didn't remember. You must be exhausted after that, right? And she didn't look exhausted. She looked kind of rested. And the whole thing was very disconcerting for me. I admittedly don't know a thing about it, but wow, it was hard to watch.
Yeah, it's upsetting for sure. I don't know anything about it being used today, but I don't know that it isn't. That just sounds weird. But
she was like mild and perky.
Often how people look on TV in the hospital after anything is ridiculously right. Perky.
Well,
and yeah. Lots of color in their face and less things.
It took me a while to realize that she had had the procedure. That's what it didn't square with me. And I was like, shouldn't she be exhausted?
This is a fun way to introduce the season finale, mm-hmm. By the way. We're here to joy.
Both feet. Yeah.
I didn't know about the memory loss. I know with lobotomy, you lose big chunks. And that was the next step, you know, for up until that was the next step. If electroshock
for depression, didn't, really?
Well, for whatever. They didn't name anything. She was blue.
No, she was blue, right? Which I guess, you know, we interpret as depression, whether that's clinical then or not. But I thought lobotomy was kind of the other way, like more manic and more, you know, uncontrollable behavior type stuff. I think between the two of us, without a single credit of psychiatric scholarship, I think we can figure this out if we talk long enough.
The Phantom, written by, take it, Dan.
Jonathan Igla and Matthew Weiner, directed by Matthew Weiner. Original air date was June 10th, 2012. This is the season 5 season finale. Megan is getting desperate about her acting career and asks Don for help. Pete and Beth reconnect before she goes in for electroshock treatment. Profits are growing.
I was going to break into song.
All right.
You need a bit of shock treatment. That goes under the category of, if you know, you know. You're welcome.
Sure does. Profits are growing at SCDP, while Peggy is beginning to shine at CGC. Marie Calvé hooks up with one Roger Sterling.
Sure does. Sure it does. That's fun.
It is. We see the slattery tush.
Oh, it's a good, it's a good tush. It's a super good tush.
That's a fit man. It's a fit man.
Actually, as you say that, I was talking with my sister last night about this episode, as I sometimes do. We were hanging out and I was like, hey, guess what I'm doing tomorrow? So, and we were just talking about the whole episode and she brought up how Vinny Kartheiser is really just the unsung sort of champion actor-wise from this show, and how he's not, I don't know if he doesn't want to work that much. He's not working at all the degree that the rest of these people. I mean, Elizabeth Moss has become a superstar. John Hamm, we just talked about. He does all those John Hamm things. Actually, John Hamm and Slattery are going to be together in, I think it's a Fletch reboot.
Oh, I or think you're
remake.
Right.
Yeah, reboot yeah. is TV. Yeah, yeah. You know, Christina had a hit show mm-hmm. for years. It just seems like Vinny.
Yeah, he's doing a lot of bit, not a lot, but what I see him is still a bit parts, you know, third lead kind of thing.
Yeah, and not that frequent.
He was prominent in that, I forget the name of it now. It's on Netflix, that show that's about the dangers of social media.
Yeah, it has a name.
You know, it's like this, yeah, it does, and I don't know it.
The social something.
Oh, the social problem.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And yeah, he plays like a futuristic sort of wizard type deal. But yeah, so yeah, you'll see him and go, oh, look who it is. And that's it.
He's so, I mean, this is just an episode where he's great. I mean, he's you know, I'm no Pete Campbell fan, but I'm a definite Vincent Kartheiser fan. He's an incredible talent. I've told this story before. I knew him from Angel, the series, which when I interviewed him years later, I knew you're not supposed to ask him about his experience on Angel the series. Angel was the Buffy sequel, basically, or spinoff, rather.
And why don't you ask? Because was it known that he had a bad experience?
Apparently, it was a bad experience. But from his performance on that show, I wasn't quite sure if he was a very bad actor or if he was poorly written and directed. And then not everybody.
When you asked him that question, what'd he say?
So I didn't ask him that question. But even our buddy Lisa from the Buffy podcast, Lisa M. Lilly, right, from Buffy and the Art of Story, she did not recognize Vinny when she first watched Mad Men. I spotted him right away, and I was immediately like, oh, he's an excellent actor. He you know, question answered is my point.
Uh-huh.
So he's great.
Yeah, I thought, listen, I think, first of all, I think as an actor, he's got a wonderfully memorable face. To me, he's an unmistakable sort of face, unique. So when I see him, I always have a certain vibe. And I think he's a bit of a sleeper in this episode and for the series. You could certainly say that. We start out the Phantom with Megan being a little on the outs with regard to her own career. She's upset about how it's going.
We have this scene with her and her friend Emily, and then her mother's in town, right? Marie's in town.
Well, that's first. We learn that she's like paid for this, which is probably a little bit soul crushing, paying for your own screen test and having them evaluated only to recommend more classes, that kind of thing.
Also to find out it was a scam. It was never going. It was never.
Yeah. It took him a week to send it back that it didn't get any traction. Right.
Here's our advice to you. Take our class. She's like, oh, shit, I got scammed. And that's what happens when you don't have to worry about money as much. You think you're making, you can make a dumber investment. And that's what she did. But she's frustrated all over. Right. She's not getting any headway. She's got all her actor friends. So she fucks one over is what happens in this episode.
She does. Emily gets thrown under the Megan bus.
Emily asks her, and it's hard to ask her, but, you know, I'm up for one of Don's clients' commercials. Could you maybe, you know, no, just get me an audition. And it was a really wonderful bait and switch when Megan starts to ask Don. You really don't see it coming.
Was she ever considering doing it for Emily, you think? Or did she immediately put herself in that request?
Upon my second viewing, there's a moment when she gets the idea in the scene with Emily.
There is.
It's subtle.
With Emily. I see. Okay.
It's subtle. Jessica Paré is maybe a better actor than Megan. We don't know how Megan is, but it is. There's this little subtle flash of something.
Okay, and I didn't catch that, but I could see that happening. Yeah, I mean it's fine as a setup and as a kind of device to get us where we need to go. I'm a little bit like Emily. If you're friends with Megan and Megan's husband is Don, asking for an audition where you still have to succeed on your merits is probably not that big of an ask. Get me in the room is not that big of an ask, I don't think. And she made it sound like a whole buildup, like she was asking to be, you know, put into a lead of a movie or something. Is it, you know what I mean? Like, hey, could you put me in with Don for this? It really is important to me. Should not feel like the be all end all. I don't know. Nitpick on my part.
Except look at how it got responded to. I mean, if you think about it, listen, Don's in advertising, and we haven't kind of seen this end of it in a while. But if you you go back to those first couple seasons, and it's like, oh, you're in advertising, which is related to TV. So it's like, oh, you're such a star, right? Mm-hmm. But even if some of that is a little bit, the shine is off of that at this point, he's the creative director and partner of an ad agency. Everybody could be asking all the time. So I think with that understanding, it's not like one person coincidentally has one connection and I'm asking you to work that connection. It's like we could be asking, all of the actors could be asking Megan to ask Don every day. And so I think that's true. They're not doing that deliberately, including the fact that it took this much to have Megan even think of it, not much less ask for it.
So Don's reaction then, I think, becomes more critical, right? In terms of, it was fascinating, I thought. It was well crafted in so much as his first reaction was kind of like, why would you want to be in a commercial? You hate advertising.
You hate advertising, which is, she's like, that's not true.
Such a horrible thing to say. It's a reductive thing to say.
Well, he's still got a dirty diaper from her leaving. And that's, you know.
well put. He does. And it's an unfair thing to say. And he's doing is bellowing about, he's still whining about her leaving with that. So it's a low blow.
The dirty diaper part is he takes it. If he truly has the thought, even if he doesn't fully believe it, but if the thought is there for him, you hate advertising, it also means he thinks you don't respect me. You think what I do is shit because you're an artist.
It's a child's view of the relationship and what's happening. He's still an 8-year-old. And that's an 8-year-old's way of thinking. Absolutely correct. So he shits on it. It's not art. And it's sort of like, I'm sorry, I don't think this is a new concept. I believe even in 1967, the idea of, hey, work is work, was still a thing. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think maybe we're more comfortable with that now. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't a thing. I don't know.
I think what you're pointing to, there started to be a bigger and bigger divide. Look at, you know, the Abe versus Peggy sort of battle. Now, Abe isn't an artist. He's a truth-telling journalist, but it's that
He's a writer.
He's a writer. Yeah. It's that same divide. It's
yeah, I write to change the world. You're
it's hippie versus corporate.
No, I think that's a good analogy.
And I think Don has decided that Megan is fully on the other side of some fence where Megan isn't.
No, he's decided Megan's Abe. In this scenario, and you're not going to be soiled by commercialism.
And Megan does not walk around and say, my art, my art, my art. She says, my audition, my audition, my audition.
Yeah, exactly. She wants to be a working actor. I think, to me, it would seem that it's still possible, I could be wrong, that Don could hold both ideas in his head at once.
But the other piece of it, so what I just said is, there's the part of it where him having her on this side, that other side of the fence, means he doesn't respect her. But I think there's another piece of it where he holds her in high regard for having this artistic integrity. Like, you don't need the money. You get to only make art for art's sake. And you don't even want to do that. He just doesn't get her at all. He doesn't get any of it.
He doesn't get it or her or what's going on. because he has this 8-year-old black and white outlook. It's like he thinks that she should be doing off Broadway for the love of it. If she strikes it big, good for her, but that'll never happen. So I win either way. Like I think there's that kind of patriarchal view of it.
Definitely.
Which we saw when she had to go out of town and all that kind of stuff.
Listen, just forget I brought any of this up. It's been so hard, you know.
So in all of this, you know, dynamic between Dawn and Megan, Marie's visiting, as you mentioned. And
what she says to Megan, poof.
A ton of things. I mean, there's a lot there. And I both love and hate Marie Calvé more and more every single time she's on the screen, right?
It's interesting. I don't know how I feel about her. It almost feels like she's just a vehicle for, I don't get a whole person there. It's not her acting necessarily. I'm not saying I'm right about that.
I think there's like a counterculture type of mom from this era. Right? Where, and maybe it's not that counter, maybe it's more counter to today's mom, which is, you know, hyper involved and all kinds of lovey dovey, you know, type of personality. But that whole idea of, thank God my children aren't my whole life, like that's a type of mom.
Sure.
You know, and it was probably a little less radical then.
Well, you're also talking about a different culture. She's French, Canadian. French
Canadian. What
is she? Is she French, right? Or yeah. French Canadian? I don't know.
She's French Canadian. Yeah, they're all Canadian. No, I agree with that. It's not that foreign to us. I think French Canadian mothers are still generally, you know, outwardly loving toward their children. In general, I just think there's a type of woman where like they don't mind being this way. It's fascinating to me.
Okay. I don't have it as a what type of mother are you thing so
but
much.
But it plays into what's going on with Dawn and Megan, I think, is the point.
She left my house a happy girl.
And you show up and she's miserable.
I know, it's hard to watch. But this is what happens when you have the artistic temperament, but you are not an artist. Take my advice. Nurse her through this defeat, and you shall have the life you desire.
Boy, she has no respect for her daughter.
One zinger after another, basically.
Yeah. And we still don't know. We don't know what degree of talent Megan has or doesn't have, because she's a very specific type of beauty. And so much of the casting, as we continue to see, is turn around and let's look at you. So yeah. She's not getting her foot in the door because she's not the type that somebody wants in a given, like they're just, it's just a matter of wait until you find the right type. She's being perceived as and cast out of looks first. And back to Marie, it's just an interesting contrast to her father, Emile, who 100% is like, you are an artist, you have an artist heart and you are an artist and you should go be an artist. That's an interesting look at that marriage.
Don't give up. Exactly.
How differently they view their daughter.
No, that's a great point. Marie is much more like just jaded beyond the word jaded even can go. You know, that's how over the edge she is. The whole thing about the world, you know, that line, it was such an amazing line. You know, the world can't handle that many ballerinas or something like that.
Not every little girl gets to do what they want. The world could not support that many ballerinas.
it goes right to your gut, you know, and for Megan, it must be crushing.
And it's so true.
Right. Unvarnished truth. Yeah.
We were all raised to believe, all of us, how special and wonderful and fantastic we are. Well, not everybody can be. It's like how everybody believes they're a better than average driver. Right?
Marie Calvé was not handing out participation. She is not that mom. But I find it fascinating because Julia Ormond plays it off wonderfully. The acting is so sharp. I feel like the contrast with what, you know, her plot line with Roger in the episode is wonderful. you know, it both complements it and plays against it. Roger hasn't given up the Marie ghost, obviously.
Yeah, isn't one of the things that is a little fun is, you know, he's really willing to shit right where he eats. I mean, he's been prank calling. Megan all day long. And then gets Dawn on the phone and pretends he's French and pretends he's Emile. And what if he had handed the phone to Megan?
The days before caller ID.
It's wild.
Yeah. 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 No, he's pretty brazen.
And you actually just realized you get another, there's a lot of, when Beth calls Pete at the office, it's your sister-in-law on the phone. There's all this like phone shenanigans that,
that's what life was
without a cell phone.
And Pete comes into the hospital as her brother.
Yeah.
All that. But yeah, it's true. I mean, what you would do when you know you wouldn't be caught calling as someone else is amazing, right? Now everything's caller ID. There's two way. Everybody knows who's calling who. There's none of that. I mean, you could, what do they do? Star 69 now, where you can hide your ID on a cell phone or whatever.
Star 67. Star 69 is how we all used to find out who called.
Okay, right. And that never worked. I could never get that number. But yeah, but you could be brazen. I mean, it's funny now with Roger, like you pointed out. But on the other hand, that wasn't that crazy then, I don't think. I don't think. You could pull it off. What the hell was anyone? You could always deny it. There was never a danger of getting caught doing that.
Well, there's the kitchen scene toward the end of, it might be Gypsy and the Hobo, toward the end of season 3, where the phone rings and nobody wants to answer it because nobody wants to get caught with whoever's calling being either Henry or Suzanne. So they just keep letting it ring and people keep hanging up and
everybody
is feeling guilty and it's a whole phone thing.
But anyway, so Roger gets his way into Marie and, you know, it feels very, it's sort of silly because of how, you know, random they are to have met up and Codfish Ball and that whole, you know, their meeting. But they are in a little kind of way soulmates, right? We see that right away, don't we?
I wouldn't go soulmates. I think so. I think they're definitely well matched, well suited to each other in some ways. We don't know in terms of a relationship what that could, you know, one of the things I saw was it's nice to see Roger really like someone, like, and it's a woman his age, you know, an age appropriate person. And again, a match for him, an intellectual, right? But he's all kind of all in and just like everything. I'm kind of like, well, what if she said yes? And just, you know, what if she just like left her husband, moved in? Well, the winning, I'm just to the bigger picture.
Oh, okay. I see.
We'll get to the acid, but it's just, you still only know each other for 5 minutes.
I feel like she has a lot of Joan in her. I think that's part of that match. Please don't ask me to take care of you is a Joan thing to say. You know, it's a sentiment that they share, I think.
So he does ask her to do acid. And I know you have some thoughts about that.
It was mostly just the observation, I think, that when they're lying on the bed like that and it's that bird's eye view, it's the same view as when he and Jane were taking acid.
Mm.
The camera angle is almost, I want to say, identical. It might have been more than just when they were lying on the floor with the turbans on, but there were just a lot of camera angles that were very, very reminiscent of the Roger and Jane conversations while they were tripping, you know? So that was it. But it's, I think that's very notable in the language of the show that they would do that. Okay. So things are going well, swimmingly at SCTP without Peggy, without Lane.
Well, they're having a little snag without Peggy, right?
Well, the topaz thing. Can I just say, I love that scene.
I know you love that scene. I'm watching it thinking Dan loves this scene.
I hate it. No, you don't.
Yeah.
Not exactly Don, you know, with Belle Jolie, you know. No, you don't.
Ginsburg is a lot more argumentative not more argumentative, just more, just less, as we've talked about, he's less filtered, and that's not always great with a client.
Oh no, with the stain on his shirt. Yeah.
I gotta say, the client was right, in my opinion. You know, it is risky to put cheap in your head.
Yeah, it's a risk. You're walking a line there, and the copy either keeps you quietly on that line or you can tip over. So it's a I looked at it as it's a discussion to be had.
And nobody
no
had.
Right or wrong.
Right. Yeah, let's workshop this. Let's look for another option that has the sentiment but doesn't have the word. Nobody said that.
So to me, that whole thing, that whole exchange, that whole everything with Stan, you know, I'm tired of this whole dynamic, right? The whole thing from start to finish for me was Peggy's not here. We need Peggy. This is the client that Peggy has eating out of her hand when she's pitching them.
Yeah, I mean, the client is like, you don't have a woman. I don't even know if he cares that it's Peggy. And then he says that racist thing about Dawn.
About Dawn, right.
We're exactly. Not repeating, but...
nobody comes off well here.
But the dynamic is...
But they miss Peggy.
They do miss Peggy, but the dynamic is also... Because after the client leaves and Dawn comes for Ginsburg, and Ginsburg says, oh, your opportunity to call me an idiot. And then that's when Stan says, I'm tired of this dynamic. So now you're like, oh, I see. This is all the time. that's what I'm tired of this dynamic
this hasn't
means.
Stopped. Yeah. I think that if Peggy were there, she would have either cut that idea off before it got in front of the client. She would have directed the client properly. She would have pitched something better. There would have been a better idea to put in front of them to begin with. It would have gone better start to finish. And that's what the missing piece here is she.
But also, Peggy was the one that Dawn would shit on, and Ginsburg was his little golden boy. That's part of what edged Peggy out. Was all the attention and all the good accounts that Ginsburg was getting. Now that Peggy's gone, Dawn is...
Well, you throw the baby out with the bathwater,
Dawn
right?
is all over Ginsburg. He's not treating him kindly anymore. He's treating him... He's got a shit on someone.
Right. So in the micro sense, things are a little rocky. But in the macro sense, the firm is thriving with new accounts and billings and everything.
The day starts with Joan and Harry in the... elevator together. He's like, you pushed the wrong
more great elevator conversation.
You pushed the wrong floor, and she's like, oh, my mistake. And you're like, what's that? Because Joan does not make mistakes, especially that kind. What we learn is they're looking at space upstairs. They're looking to double, I think, the size of the office.
In a worst kept secret kind of way, right? Because Harry's onto it and she has to cover. Yeah.
What's never said, Lane's absence, Lane's tragedy is all over this episode. But but they never use the words and connect the dots with words, because it's unnecessary to say. And especially because as the audience, we know it was financially driven. This, what pushed him over the edge, again, a depressive is a depressive. I'm not saying one that people kill themselves over finances. We know this from 1929. Crash, we just know this.
Of course.
And so the unsaid irony of this whole episode is, if he had just waited 5 minutes,
a change of fortune was around the corner.
And it was partly his doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, as much as he bloated that he brought in Jaguar, and he didn't, Pete did, but he did open that door.
He was involved. He had reason to be proud of it coming out the way it did. But, you know, nobody, while your point is spot on, nobody besides Dawn knows that his taking his own life was financially motivated. That's not common knowledge.
Except what we brought up last time. Bert's walking around knowing something.
Something.
And seems to not have said anything to Dawn about it. Just seems to have left it alone. Whatever they did wrong in Bert's head is buried with Lane at this point.
Whatever, you know, we touched on it in commissions and fees discussion, that Bert probably should have gone to Don and said, what, you know, I'm going to follow up on this now. Close the circle for me. I come in with this mysterious check, and a week later, the guy's dead. So what's up, right? So that probably should have resonated for Bert.
Yeah, and it probably does. He's not dumb. He's on top of shit. And then you have the partners meeting where they're talking about how they're making money. Things are looking good. They've had their best quarter ever and are projected to have a better one. Mm. And now think about it. Best quarter ever means with Lucky Strike and all that success in the beginning, this is their best quarter ever.
I just love Joan now running that meeting like a fucking Swiss watch. And Pete's agitated and walks out, and Don's like, can we do that?
Yeah, that was great. I love that. But Joan looks at Lane's empty chair and then says, nobody is talking about maybe not doing this. She was just saying we should do this.
Yeah.
And then she looks at Lane and realizes what Lane would say.
Yeah.
And she channels that and says, or we should be cautious and not do this and maybe wait till June. I just thought that was really beautiful. I mean, part of it is a tribute to Lane. And part of it is, as we talked about a while ago, Joan could do this job. Joan could do Lane's job.
And she already is. I mean, that's the thing. She knows she's in Don's office. She's like, the money is like rolling in. Like, we can afford to do this. The second floor is not extending ourselves. Yeah. Like, we can do this.
We can really do this.
Yeah. So that's the atmosphere. That's the circumstance at the office. And they are looking at that floor above, which they said they had when they opened, but they didn't.
Yeah. No, it was that's the phantom, actually. Different meanings of that's the phantom. True. That second floor has been a phantom the whole time.
Absolutely.
But speaking of phantom, Don's got this toothache. And that's sort of this weird underlying sort of metaphory thing happening. He's in pain, but he's walking around in pain, but it's fine. It'll go away. It always does, which, by the way, that's a thing you say as you get older. And they don't go away the way, whatever it is, just because it always used to go away, that shit starts to change.
Recovery is slower.
And sometimes things finally take hold and make you sick. Not that I would know. So he's got this phantom sort of thing causing pain. And he keeps seeing Adam. After Lane hangs himself and Don hugs his body to the ground. Not right. Surprising. I mean, we brought this up in that episode. I forgot that he has Adam's sightings in this episode, but several.
Right down to the rope marks.
Yes.
And look, I think is it a little on the nose? Yeah. Is it, but still, is it artistically satisfying or surprising enough? Because it's not like, you know, every third episode or fifth episode, Don is seeing Adam, right? The wound of the loss and Don's guilt is so buried or baked into everything, but it's never explicit, right? It comes out when he's caught by Betty. He mentions his brother. I think one other time he mentions his brother, perhaps in the last couple seasons. But it's so buried that when this happens, it's a little bit. I can get off the. I can get over the being on the nose part of it.
The other piece of it from Don's psychology is things are getting sad again for Don. The shine of the marriage is worn off. The honeymoon phase is over. Love leave is over. And he's just sort of back to himself again. I'm not as happy. My marriage is not that great. But, you know, he's just feeling the old Don, unresolved, agitated. I mean,
it's an oeuvre.
You could take Pete's speech, which we will get to later, put Pete's speech onto Don. And therefore, his older, these bigger guilts are going to pop up. It's not just Adam is my point. My point is Adam is now his symptom of all of his schmutz.
No, I think that's very valid. I mean, you know, I'll throw in there, you know, the whole Dow speech, right? He's over being passive about the firm and his career and his work, which he was for most of the season. That's the broader arc of Don for this season, right? Is in some way getting his mojo back professionally, but that's not an unambiguous thing, because with that comes this deeper issues that crop up.
Yeah, and this season has also been about Don trying to be happily married. Mm-hmm. And as we see in the last shot, you know, that's one season down, and we'll probably have a very different season by next time, right?
And what's interesting, I guess, about this episode, which is very hard to pin down as a finale or anything else, is these are all things that are kind of coming to a head relatively late. We're just seeing the aftermath of Lane's death, and all of these things that have been building all season are now with the tooth and with that. Like, it's all happening in this one episode. There's very, very little, even as there's all these other clues, they're indirect. But all these things are now rushing to a head in the last 60 minutes, which is weird to see. It's not like Don had a toothache all season or for the last couple of weeks, or, you know, Adam's been cropping up in different ways, direct. And it's all been totally buried until it rushes up to the top.
Or we've had any real sense that the company is going to thrive.
Yeah, it's been uncertain.
It's been almost looking like it was going to tank to uncertain. We've only ever gotten to uncertain. This was like, oh, we didn't know that.
Yeah, everything's like slowly build and then all at once. And the way things happen too. I mean, it's not unrealistic. It's just artistically, it's a choice. And it plays with your your sense of the pace of the show. And it's a different kind of finale for sure.
What can I do for you?
I want to reopen the conversation about more space.
You're not going to put anybody in here, are you?
No. It's just I've been trying so hard to be so responsible and careful, and I don't even know why, because every day I open the mail and there's more money.
That's the idea, isn't it?
I got this morning. The death benefit from the company insurance policy. It's $175,000.
So what's your question?
So coming out of that meeting with Joan and Don, there's this insurance payment that comes back. And I guess, and it's the firm's, right? It's not Rebecca's. Honestly, this brings up a couple issues for me, which I touched on, right?
You did. I thought of you. You had brought up that Don is making decisions without partners. That's what you brought up with the check, the first check.
I brought it up in regards to what happens to Lane's shares. That, right, it wasn't the money per se. It was if Lane is being fired / quitting, technically resigning, then there's the matter of what happens to his ownership in the firm.
That's right. But you were all... Right,
that was my initial.
Yeah, and you were all over. He just made a partner's decision without the partners. And I was kind of like, oh, but that's okay. But now that I saw him do this, which also, if it had been a one-off, I might have... But I'm like, this is a pattern now.
It is. And listen, we can choose to see it as the Jaguar decision with Joan and sleeping with that guy when he walks out of the room, right? So even though they were legally and technically within their rights to make that decision without Don, Don might emotionally be saying, fuck you guys, I'll make decisions myself when necessary, right? So we can see it in that context also. But regardless...
And so far, it's only on this one topic, which is Lane.
Right. And now this is another financial matter regarding Lane, and... Again, Don's the only one that knows it was a financially motivated act. And so when he sees the money, what was it, 125 or 150 from the insurance company that she said? He asks, how much was that extra contribution? So he's still not addressing his ownership. Mm. He's making good on like this one little, not little, but this one specific portion of buy into the firm. So technically, Lane shares are still with the firm, or at least the dominant portion of Lane shares minus the 50K. But he takes the 50K and says, we'll pay that, I guess, because it's the most recent contribution. takes that to Rebecca's. And here's another instance of Don trying to pay off, not a debt per se of his own. In fact, it's not a debt at all, but it's guilt money that Don's always seems to be carrying.
Yeah. And also Don being the good boy, Don being a good one. I'm a good one. I'm not the one who leads to destruction in my path. Like Adam say, I'm the one who's a good boy and I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah. It's like licking a wound that it's not that the wound isn't there. It's that he's licking the wrong arm. You know, the wound is not improving.
Because he got an abscess in his mouth.
Correct. So
no, but that's a good connection. That we haven't seen a Don handling things with money in a while, especially with women and money. But there it is. You're right.
It's Midge. It's Adam. It's Anna's sister. It's just on and on. Nonstop. It's Betty, for God's sake. So here it is again, and this one isn't, Rebecca's not having it. She gives it to him with both barrels. But even her take is like a little wacky, right?
Well, yeah, it's belittling to Lane. It's the yeah. marriage. It's Rebecca. I mean, you know, that marriage, he had to suck up being miserable with her. And I mean, he really genuinely sucked it up. We never saw him be unhappy with her again. But I did point out the guy was drinking a lot last season. You started to see that from A Little Kiss all the way through. So he really was edging towards, you know, a break. I mean, he was, but that's how he was managing that pain. And there she is, and she says it right out loud. You don't fill a man like that with dreams. Is that the line?
With ambition.
Yeah. What a horrible thing to say.
It's an unenlightened thing to say, is what it is. And it's sort of like, you know, I hear something like that, and I go, it's your marriage, Rebecca. And he's your husband. To dump that on Don or the firm is wrong. It's just wrong.
She just saw him. It's just so, it's just, to me, it's such a window into that marriage. It's just, right. She only sees him. She sees no possibility for this person. He's only one thing. And anytime he tries to step out of being that one thing, she smacks him back into it while spending his money.
And complaining to him all the time.
Buying a friggin' Jaguar.
I see him this way, and this way is flawed. And I'm not going to blame him for that flaw that I think he has. I'm blaming you for that flaw I think he has, which he may or may not be a flaw. But I'm still interpreting it as a flaw, and I'm blaming you for it. So it's like, what the fuck, Rebecca?
I don't see it as her blaming him for it. It's for not recognizing his... You treated him with respect. What were you thinking? It broke him.
My husband should be a pencil pusher in an office and stay close to home and just leave the ambition somewhere else for other people. That's not who he is. Oh, but he has ambition and he's now doing this. Well, that's him. Like, that's like, if you think that's wrong, number one, that's him. That's not other people. Okay. He's responsible for his own ambition, if that's the case. Number two, it's debatable whether that's wrong. You know, you can't say that it's wrong for him to be ambitious. That's his choice. He's got his own agency in this. So you're now blaming it on other people. I think the whole thing is cockeyed and mislabeled all the way around.
It's awful. It's awful.
She really is. I don't think we've really had a sympathetic moment with Rebecca.
Belittling, infantilizing. You know, this is not a man who should be making up his own mind. And how dare you contribute to him even thinking he could? Yeah, it's just awful.
So Don gets the hell out of there as fast as he can, as he should.
Feeling more guilt. The problem is he took in the scolding.
He, because he had his own guilt, right? Because that no one knows about. So for sure. So that's kind of where that ends. It's unfortunate. It's very sad. It's just, it's done. Which brings us to the happy couple of the episode. You know, we get was it Howard? Yeah, Howard and Beth on the train seeing Pete. And, oh, Beth's going to her sister's, wink, wink. Long story short, you know, it's made clear that she's going for shock therapy.
You need a bit of ooh, shock treatment. Oh.
My favorite part of the episode was when they broke out into song. And then the conductors got into it, too, which was really cool. But...
So she calls Pete in the office. She calls Pete,
yeah.
And it was interesting because he... So first he does... Actually, on the train, he does that little scarf pull as they walk away. So he's very... As much as he's hurt and he's kind of angry, which is what we see in this next office scene, but on the train, we still see that he's pining. And mm-hmm. super overly romanticized version of pining. but then she calls him in the office. Now, the last time we saw her was the fantasy version of her coming into his office. That exact yes. same office with a fur coat and nothing else. So the fact that she calls and he's like, what are you doing calling me at my office? I'm yeah, like...
Just like I wanted you yeah. to, right.
So, and she says, you know... Meet me the same place you wanted to meet last time. It could be our last chance. And he's resisting and resisting and resisting, but we know he's going to show up. She knows he's going to show up.
As he says, because she knows he's pathetic. What's his line?
Which is right. not where her, that's not how she's judging him at all.
No, but it's his interpretation. I mean, he's entitled to feel a little manipulated here, but he's also acknowledging that he's going along with it.
They get together and they have the good sex and he feels the feelings and maybe she feels the feelings. It's very hard to know any of what's real for her, like what the experience, any of these experiences are for her.
It's a bit of a, take of it what you will as a viewer, right? I this was like the last good scene between them for me, where I like that dynamic of her saying, look, I know how this goes. This is my version of 51st Dates, right? So I'm going to enjoy this moment because the moment's going to be gone and I'm not going to have it. And I'd rather have it and not remember it than to have never had it. And I like that. I like that sentiment. I like that expression. So I'm with them. As a viewer in that hotel room for that.
What makes you think I would do this? You are crazy.
Please. Please give me this.
What I take of his response to her revelation about where she's going is that he's not exactly enlightened about the psychiatric treatment that she's getting.
But it's very consistent with Pete Campbell, how he... That's his father through and through is
adoption, the whole thing.
Yeah, you're weak and you have to, that's a weak solution. You should be able to solve your own problems. Freddie, pee your pants, right? That's his, it's very consistent.
Yeah.
And I thought that was good character work.
I agree. It really is. That's who Pete Campbell is. That's how he was raised and that's how he lives his life.
You know, we've talked, you and I, back and forth, Pete, his ennui. It took me a little while to come on board with, oh, he really is depressed. I mean, it's hard because I just see him as such a miserable person who feels misery and causes misery everywhere he goes. So it's been hard for me to sort of recognize the depression. But Beth recognized it. Pete says, and what if you forget you love me, which is what you're addressing. But she says, oh, Peter, I don't know you and you don't know me. We just happen to have the same problem. So there's two things there that I love. Part one, right. I love the we don't know each other. Like I always love a sobering cutting through. I think we've talked about this before. This isn't
a fairy tale.
We
right.
literally don't know each other. What are you talking about? So that's that. And then she says, we just happen to have the same problem.
That's right.
And that. The fact that she likes Pete because she recognizes the depression, that's something.
I think so.
And then he says, I know, but we are only sad because we're apart. And she says, oh, then I was wrong.
Right. But that's also Pete probably misreading the situation. his that response of
peace. Well, both. Yes, it's both. It's both not willing to take her invitation to look inward.
Correct.
And he's back to pining, and everything's about the pining.
Right. I'm unhappy because of what I don't have. And if I identify what I don't have, I can at least try to get it. And that's how I deal with it.
Which doesn't really cover why he was sad 5 minutes before he met Beth.
Yeah, exactly. But then having met Beth and still being sad, well, it must be because I can't be with Beth.
Oh, totally. That's the cycle that he's in. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I'm here with them through this. Where I'm where I'm not with them is when he gets into her hospital room post treatment, and she's like another person. Like I said, a little perky, a little vague, a little, you know, obviously doesn't remember him at all. Doesn't even know his name or where he's from.
I loved that, the scripting of that, by the way. And her acting is terrific, but it takes you a minute to know that she doesn't remember him. It takes him a minute, yeah. Because that's what we do as humans. It's like people with Alzheimer's. It's like, there's no like, wait, I don't remember. You're covering up. You're behaving. You're putting on the face as best as possible. I'm like, I got this. And then he's like, you don't know me. And she, you know, then she's like, well, yeah, but, or he said, and he covers for her. He says, I must have the wrong room. Once it becomes apparent that she, yes, absolutely doesn't, yes, remember him, but she starts by not being like, who the fuck are you?
No, there's like a play acting thing going on where he picks up and she's not acting at all.
She knows she says, I don't have a brother. She got that part.
Yeah, I couldn't, this whole thing, if there's some cosmic revelation in all of this, or we're supposed to link it to something or make something of it, it's too deep and buried for me. His whole speech about the friend
Hate it. It is a little, we've said this all season. There's, and we've already said it in this episode. It's a little on the nose. It also a little bit has the rhythm of, like, Matt was trying to do another season two Peggy monologue, that brilliant.
I definitely got that, right? Rhythm for sure.
You know, you love, yeah, you have this part of you and gave it away and all that, or it's gone. So this is, he says, he's talking about his friend that he's visiting in the hospital, which is him, right? And he says, so he's now talking about himself. He says, I guess he needed to let off some steam. He needed adventure. He needed to feel handsome again. He needed to feel that he knew something. Now, I'm going to even pause myself and interrupt me. This is what happens when you're a creator, when you're writing. You're figuring it out as you're creating it. So he's figuring this out as it's coming out of his mouth.
Oh, I agree. It's a stream of consciousness.
Yeah, and he's finally got some insights here, but he didn't have them 5 minutes ago. And he's just finally, this moment, for whatever reason, the power of seeing that Beth was not just a fantasy for him. She literally, it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And it just, it took him somewhere. So, back to...
Well, it was shock therapy for his situation, too, you could say.
So, back to my interrupting myself, unpause. He needed to be handsome again. He needed to feel that he knew something, that all this aging was worth something, because he knew things young people didn't know yet. He probably thought it would be like having a few tall drinks and feeling very, very good. And then he'd go back to his life and say, that was nice. And then she says, but then he got sick. And he says, when it went away, which is right now, this moment.
Yeah, which is happening as we speak.
He was heartbroken. And then he realized everything he already had was not right either. And that was why it had happened at all. So Trudy, he is finally seeing Cobb,
the house,
that, right, what he has isn't right, and that is why this affair happened at all. And then he says, and that his life with his family was some temporary bandage on a permanent wound. It's the first time he admits to himself he's not happy with his life.
Yeah, yeah.
And the notion that he has a permanent wound is a powerful you know, it's a great.
Yeah, that predates Trudy, basically.
Yeah. It's a great starting place to do some inner work. It's probably where he's going to stop.
But you've opened my eyes. I now see it as a meaningful part of the story. I can grant that. Still didn't love it, but I like that it has a place.
No, this was never my favorite storyline, but it is to hear him say, oh, this affair, and this whole my being in love is a symptom of my bullshit. Not quite how
that's
said
a revelation.
It. It is a revelation. Yeah.
No, that's exactly what it is. Okay. I'll get there. Okay. I'll get there. I think that's meaningful. I was too bored and, you know, probably scrolling my phone to really get
it. I had to rewind it like three times to appreciate it. And I just decided, because I kind of was tuning it out too. And I'm like, let me go back because I think this might be really important.
not something that grabs you. Didn't grab me.
But that's because I dismiss Pete a lot, you know.
But when we put it now in the context of what happens after or somewhere in the middle of all this with the plan for the pool. And I do like his comments about the pool. That seems very permanent.
Well, there's permanent again, right?
Digging a hole in the ground and filling it with water. That is pretty permanent. And Tammy could drown, you know, like, well, you're really a barrel of fun. That this depression, this ennui, this everything is, Trudy is now, you know, had it up to here with that, right? Because all she does is sit there all day trying to make things better and make the house better and do it for Tammy and the family. And like, he's not the least bit of a willing participant.
And then, but then she does a really kind, you know, oh, so there's the train ride home.
Yeah.
Where apparently Pete...
He just lets it all out.
Apparently Pete gets punched so frequently that Trudy's worried about him and car accidents. We know he's a bad driver, but you had another car accident? And it's like, no, oh, that's what he's been saying every time he gets punched.
Yeah. No, and the car's fine.
He's on the train, Howard, having just left his wife in the hospital for... shock treatment.
Sure.
Now wants to go party in the city with Pete because he's single for the week or whatever.
That's what you do.
And Pete it inflames Pete, understandably.
But Pete kind of reveals what's up.
That's right.
You know,
he absolutely lets the cat out of the bag. And Howard was like, oh, it was you. And so there's a little touch of Howard suspects she's fucking somebody and puts her back in the hospital. Mm-hmm. There's a little touch of that. Now, it's not the only thing, because what she says to Pete in the hotel room is, you know, but it works. Meaning we now know she's got a history of this, and it's not just Howard making her do it.
Yeah, Howard thinks he's doing it for one reason. She sees other benefits.
She sees, you know, what might be the genuine benefits if there isn't a better solution. It's a big sacrifice, but it does seem to snap her out of something for a while. Again, I don't really know much about it, but it does. She says it helps.
Seems like it wipes the hard drive.
But he definitely makes it seem punitive in that scene. And then he beats up Pete, and then Pete pulls a Karen on the conductor.
Yeah, that's kind of farce, but
I pay your salary, Patty LuPone.
But then he goes home and you know, it fell in a ditch or whatever. But Trudy kind of relents on I think she sees how unhappy he is, and yes, let's do the apartment.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of sweet of her. But it's the timing for him to hear that, like,
yeah. Right.
You know, he's just miserable. Like, he's really miserable right now. He doesn't have this lover. But there's just no joy in that.
There's no joy.
And there would have been joy had she said yes earlier. Like, he wants that escape apartment.
But I link that right to the image we see in the montage at the end, right? Pete just trying to get to the next day. let me put these headphones on, shut out the world. I'll wake up and I'm getting back on that fucking train. And, you know, that's the Cheever novel, right? I mean, that to me is that link back to, which we see a lot with Don, or used to see a lot with Don. That's now Pete with that unhappiness in the suburbs, which we've seen. That's nothing new, but it's sort of the state of play at the moment.
Hey, Dan, let's take a break.
Can we? Let's break. We'll come back. with a little more Donna Megan. And we got some Peggy.
And we got some, hey, it's the finale.
So our girl Peggy is up and doing the town, right? She's living life. CGC life.
She's going to the movies, pulling a Don Draper.
well, that's after she gets.
Yeah, she gets handed. Some... She gets handed Virginia Slims. I don't think they ever say the brand, but she goes to Virginia at the end, right?
Well, I think the thing was it wasn't named yet.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Tell her to
yet.
Come up with a name. Yeah. And it's a great. I like the scene with
Ted Shaw.
Right. He's kind of not hand-holding, not sugarcoating it for her. He's treating her like the pro that she is. You know, I don't smoke. Sure you do. You know, but he puts the button on it. You know, what do you want? Like, this is about what you want, right? That's advertising.
Yeah, it's great. She's so he comes in and he says, you know, we've got this woman's cigarette. I want you on it. Now, we know the value of a cigarette as a brand for an agency.
And it was a cast off, right? They said, you know, DDB didn't want it or something like that.
It's the woman's brand.
It's a way in.
She's just asking, she's just looking for the intel. You know, what else do they want that you're not telling me? Cause he's like, here's the research, but we want you. And then she just says what else? And he's like, no, it's whatever you want, you know? And it's really, it's lovely. It's powerful and respectful.
But it's a way into her world right now, which is exciting. It's untethered to Don, which is very new, obviously. It's what she always wanted, which is to find out if I'm really good at this. Like, I know I'm good at this, but I've always done it in this very peculiar environment of Don Draper and whatever the firm is doing, and everyone sees us as this thing. Now it's out there in the wide world, and I think that's awesome to see. Mm. Right. So, yeah. And of course, you know, just because she's away from Don doesn't mean she hasn't picked up his habits, i.e. going to the movie theaters in the middle of the day.
Yeah. And it was quite a day because what happens right before Ted comes in is she's just, you know, yelling at some juniors. You know, I need 130 words and 15 of them have to be Ajax. You know, so she's been there long enough that she's just in the aggravated grind of it all. Then she gets handed this huge account, and then she's like, you know what I want to do? Go to the movies.
Get inspired.
Yeah. Hopefully not give a hand job.
Right, which is what I thought was going to happen when Don showed up. But yeah, so it was a nice little scene, them there.
They hug.
Yeah, she went a little too far with the "we all should go out sometime." That I think Don was like,
"That'll never happen." But she always says that stuff, and that's fine. They all should. They're just not gonna.
It was a nice scene, and it was nice that they were both, because even he says like, "It's a little soon for you to be playing hooky," you know, or whatever it is, and you know, he knows it's not playing hooky. She knows it's not playing hooky. Just looks like it, but no, it was a cute moment. I loved it.
I'm proud of you. I just didn't know it would be without me.
Well, put me on your call list.
What are you working on?
We're trying to get that women's cigarette you were after.
God, I miss that easy money.
It's easy to have. It's not easy to win.
You'll beat it.
He says the line about succeeding.
Well, first of all, she's sitting just like Don is, with the arm over the chair and the cigarette in her fingers.
Oh, very nice.
Just like very noticeable. When you help someone succeed, they move on, which is both self-serving and complimentary.
Yeah, and it's also what's on his mind with Megan.
Yeah, yeah, very much.
And she says, don't you want that? Isn't that what you want? You know, he has a hard time with that part. But I do think that impacts... what happens next, you know, what he does for Megan.
Right. It's sort of like, I have the power to help people.
Yeah. Why are you, why you got to be stingy?
And the position. Right. Yeah. I have the power and the opportunity to help people. I should do it more often. I mean, maybe no more complicated than that.
Apparently I don't want my wife to succeed. That was so yeah. Maybe I should stop doing that. So anyway, it was great. It was great to see Peggy doing great. We haven't seen her in a few episodes because it's Mad Men. And I mean, there's no Betty in this finale either.
No Betty.
There's no Betty.
No.
And there's been no Peggy for a few weeks. So it's great to see her. And they're, you know, that was a wonderful scene with her and Dom. It's great.
Yeah. Loved it. Loved it. You know, this episode hinges on just that, right? How does Don take that opportunity to help Megan, which she explicitly asked for? And again, you can't remove Marie from the situation here, in my opinion. I think that because she's been kind of chirping at Don, and there's been all this dissatisfaction from Megan is being stoked by Marie at the same time, like we said. So it's coming to a head very quickly, and Megan's unhappiness is evident to everybody. And I think after the movie, you know, Don goes and watches another movie, this one of Megan's Reel.
Yeah, wasn't that lovely?
Wonderful. I thought that was a great way to end the season, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, he's watching her and he's seeing the Anne Margaret version that is Megan. You know, he's seeing the star quality. He's seeing the woman he loves.
She's got a real Natalie Wood look to her, especially in that silent black and white reel that she shows. I saw like a Natalie Wood type of look.
She doesn't hit me that way just because the blue eye. To me, that Natalie Wood's brown eyes are so doughy and hers are so blue, but whatever.
But in that black and white reel, that's how I saw
it. She's, I mean, whatever it is, you really see the star quality of her, you know, and he's looking at that and he's...
undeniable, right? Like, that's the part of it too. It's like, no, this isn't just a pretty girl who could hit. She's a beauty.
And it's just all there for him. That's the woman I'm madly in love with. That's the woman who wants this. And I'm somehow not on board with this.
Rediscovering.
Right. Yeah. Really, really moving. So he does it.
Yeah. The next thing we see, the next thing we see is reminiscent of the Coke set with Betty.
Very much.
Is Megan in costume for Butler Shoes.
Yep. She's and Beauty and the Beast.
They're doting over her. Right. Beauty and the Beast. They're doting over her and getting her prepped and ready. And he
walks away.
He walks away.
There's two closing shots of this episode. I mean, that's the closing shot of the episode, right? Is him walking away, the James Bond theme. He's in the bar.
What was that? You Only Live Twice, right? Uh-huh. That was the song? Right, which is sort of like, you're doing this again.
Yeah. Right. And he's also Don's got that sort of
swagger.
Stepping back into the James Bond swagger. Exactly. Exactly.
Now, was that bar is not on the set, right? There is a fade out, fade in from
there was
the set
no fade.
To the bar.
There was no fade. I don't know how. No, it was filmed as though it was all one long hallway, sort of.
Right. But there is there's a cut where you can see where there's where if they were intending to show that it's a different location, where that cut takes place, but it's really not clear. Like, you have to either be paying attention or looking for it somehow.
I didn't see a cut.
But there's not typically restaurants on commercial sets.
No, I understand. I thought maybe it isn't a hotel.
It's not literally there.
Maybe it's in a hotel conference room. I don't know. I don't know how that.
Okay. So do you think literally it's in the same location that it's?
I haven't thought about it that hard.
30 feet. Okay. Because, yeah, from the first time I remember seeing it, it was always like, oh, is this right? He's having this, you know, do you have a light? This is taking place right while she's filming right there. Like, that was weird. But I don't think it is upon looking at it. I don't think it is. I think it's meant to, the confusion is meant to show that Don is not that far removed from having helped his wife and he's back to being a tomcat.
Unresolved. The other closing shot that wasn't the closing shot is the five of them up on the second floor.
Oh, statement piece.
I mean, gorgeous. Now, I've worked in enough New York buildings, and I'm sure you have too, and there is often another floor. I've moved, so I've been, I've seen that. it still looks just like that. It doesn't look any different. The empty office,
it's wonderful,
with the flat behind it, meaning the shot of the city, which is a painting on Mad Men. It's a big painting of that gorgeous, but that's what it looks like. That's exactly, I've stood right there. And so have you.
But they're framed in the windows and it's beautiful. And Joan is kind of with the curves.
And they're all five individual different places. Like it's the group of them. So it's got the cohesion.
But they're framed in their individual windows.
But they're each in their own column.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they are all five very separate people. I mean, we know the Lisa. Listen, Bert Cooper is the one person we never follow home, ever.
Yeah.
You know, the most we've ever done is his sister Alice Cooper, always laughs every time, has come into the office.
We see him once at home, and it hasn't happened yet.
Fair enough. But anyway, that I loved that. That, I mean, it's not only, it's a gorgeous shot, it's a hero shot, it's a phenomenal shot. It's a very New York office shot, and how they're separate they are is this juxtaposition to look at the team back together. You know, it's really interesting.
The beauty of it for me is this ability to do this very artistic, very high styled statement portrait shot in a way that totally, completely, organically fits within the story. Like there is a reason for that shot taking place and you get to do that shot. Whereas most of the time it's shoehorned in or there's something very engineered about it. Right. It wasn't leading up to this. We weren't waiting for it. It wasn't missing if we didn't know that they were going to do it, but they did it. And you kind of just are in awe of the look. And yet they're looking at their new space. It's been building for a couple of years now. They're growing and they're doing well. So they're going to have this moment, but shit, they didn't have to do it like that. It's just beautiful.
So that's it. That's the Phantom. That's the season finale. Hold tight. One more quick break. Couple things to let you know.
There it is. We've seen the Phantom. We've experienced.
We've been haunted.
Phantom. We've been haunted by the Phantom. That stupid tooth.
Oh God.
that's the image of this episode, and it's kind of awful because, well, as we said, it's not the best finale example of the show. We shall say. So that's when I think of the Phantom, I think of that stupid tooth on the dentist. And it was like, you know, anyway, there's been better, but but it's all relative.
In our rankings. Thank you all so much for supporting us. A reminder, they coined it pod at patreon.com. I'm going to say that, reverse it. patreon.com/theycoinedpod is how to join us, is how to support us. And then the members are going to be joining us. Invited to join us for the They Joined It, one of the worst plays on They Coined It any of us came up with, but we're stuck with
or
it.
Or the best.
Thanks, guys. We will see you soon.
Thank you. If you would like to support the show, as many of our listeners do, go to patreon.com/theycoinedpod. You get mini bonus episodes and other treats. Another way to support us is to leave us a glowing review on Apple Podcasts. Email us at questions@theycoinedpod.com or on Twitter and Instagram at @TCIMadMenPod. They Coined It is produced and edited by Roberta Lipp. Our logo and merch graphics are by Albert Stern of Stickrust Arts. Our theme is from Adam Tilford. Thanks again for listening. I'm Dan Jasper. See you next time.